Roger, can see on the slide here the message today is a journey through the biblical calendar. Whereas believers, I believe it's important that we understand this. And I will say, I talked to enough people to believe that a review is not a bad thing. I want to begin, actually, by reviewing the 2024 date. So this is one reason I'm giving this message this year. And it's important that we're reminded why we have two different dates. This will be unique to us and maybe a few other assemblies out there. But so we have early dates and we have late dates. So real quickly, and if you want to take a photo of this, you can do that now. But Passover Memorial, March 24th, and that's the evening, by the way. Unleavened Bread, March 26th through the 1st. There's a small asterisk here indicating that it may be the day before. Highly, highly unlikely. Feast of Weeks, May 12th. Trumpets, September 5th. Atonement, September 14th. Tabernacles, September 19th through the 25th. In the last great day, September 26th. So the late dates, and this would follow, by the way, the Jewish calendar this next year, the 19-year cycle. I'm not going to talk about that, but I guess I'll just real briefly. The Jews, to keep the season, to keep the calendar within the right season, they use what's called a 19-year cycle. And every few years, they add what's called a biblical leap year, which essentially is just a 13th month. But again, they do that to make sure that the calendar is maintained within the right season. So the late dates, this would be a Passover, be April 22nd. Again, that would be the evening of. The Unleavened Bread would be April 24th through the 30th. June 30th or June 16th would be Feast of Weeks or Pentecost. Trumpets, October 5th. Atonement, October 14th, Tabernacles, October 19th through the 25th, and the last great day, October 26th. Now, people are asking, do you have any preferences or do you have any predictions? Well, my preference would be the later dates. That'd be my preference. But as you know, we can't determine when the dates are. That's Yahweh's thing to do. But I will say, based on the trends, I lean towards the early dates. I lean towards the early days, but it could be late days. It's certainly feasible. So we'll wait, and we'll see what happens. So why do we have two sets of days? Well, the reason goes to the method Yahweh uses to calculate or determine the calendar. Unlike the calendar we use today, the Gregorian calendar, the biblical calendar is based on observation, and that's why we wait. And that's why some years we can't predict. And we know it's observation of the crops and observation of the new moon crescent. For this reason, there are certain years that are less predictable than others. Most of the time, we don't have two projections for the year. Oftentimes, though, we do have projections for the month because there is a possibility maybe the moon may be seen the day later or a slight chance, generally, that the new moon may be seen a day before. But this year is a little bit unique. Every 3 or 4 years, we have a year like this where we don't know when Abib will fall, and Abib is the first biblical month. Now, as we'll hear in the message, the way the first biblical month is determined is by the use of the Abib barley. We'll see lots of evidence for this as we go through this. And again, most years are safe to predict. But this year, even though I lean towards the early dates, it could be the late dates, which I'm kind of hoping for because I like late feasts. I like cool feasts. Not everybody agrees with me. Some people, they love the 80 degrees during the feast. I tell them, go down to the Caribbean. Because we like, at least I like, the fall crisp, cool feasts in the fall. But we'll see. It's up to Yahweh. It's up to him. And we'll know, by the way, by March 11th. So if you want to know a date, March 11th, we'll have to make a determination. And March 11th is a day, the new moon day, for that month. And we'll talk more about this, but we need to know by then whether the barley is an Abib. If the barley is not an Abib by March 11th, or then we will then add a month, which would make March a leap year, or an astral, so we're at a 13th month, or a Dar 2, by the way, is what it's called by the Jews, a Dar 2. A Dar is the name of the 12th month, or Dar 2, is the name of a 13th leap year, or a 13th month. Now, I know this all may still be a bit confusing, but I'm hoping after we're done here that we will all understand how to determine the biblical year. I'm expecting great things, by the way, from our teens, because last teen discipleship or youth discipleship, we reviewed this. So I'm expecting great things from our teens. With the biblical calendar, there are three basic metrics we need to understand, and they are basic. Now, there's nuances beyond this. I'm not going to say there's not more to it. There is. There's more to understanding how to project a new moon, for instance. But it's easy to understand how to use the new moon. So, number one, first metric is to begin the day. That is done by sunset. Number two, we need to understand how to begin the month. And number three, maybe I should put this number one, but number three, we need to understand how to begin the year. And that's probably the most controversial, how to begin the year. We'll talk more about that as we go through this message. Once we understand these metrics, understanding Yahweh's calendar becomes fairly simple. It's not hard. It really isn't complicated. Some people that will say so complicated, or try understanding how they devise the Gregorian calendar, or the Julian calendar, or many of the other calendars, or the Jewish calendar, the modern Jewish calendar. Understand all the nuances and the differences of how they determine their postponements and how that works. Believe me, Yahweh's calendar is very simple when we understand these basic metrics. Much, much easier to understand than the convoluted calendars of today and even of other nations. I want to begin today by looking at when the biblical day begins. Real simple. When does the biblical day begin? Genesis 1 verse 5, we find a verse that provides two definitions for the word day within that single verse. It says, "And Elohim called the daylight, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day." So we find here day one of creation. Find here that in the beginning, that Yahweh created the heavens and the earth. And within this passage, we find two definitions for the word day. The first definition is found in the phrase, "And Elohim called the light day." And then he says he called the darkness night. So just a distinction there between the daylight portion and the night portion of the day. We find here that Yahweh draws the distinction between the day and night. So we find here Yom, and Yom, by the way, is a Hebrew word for day, Yom. Yom here does refer to the hot portion or to the daylight portion of the day. So Yom can refer just simply to the daylight portion of the day. Now we find a second definition here for the word Yom or day when it says in the evening and morning. Find here that through this, another way to understand Yom or day is 24-hour day. Beginning when? Beginning in the evening. In the evening. Not in the morning, beginning in the evening. You see, Yahweh's days begin in the evening. The Hebrew word here for evening is Arab. It means dusk. Arab comes from the Hebrew Arab, and it means to grow dusk at sundown. So that's how we start the day. That's why Sabbath begins not on sunrise Saturday, but sunset Friday. It begins the day before. Now again, the word day comes from the Hebrew yom. I want to share a few references with you on this word. Oops. I did not do that. I can do quite a bit up here, but I cannot turn the music on. That's a first. I tell you. You know, I leave for 1 week. I'm going to have to postpone my future vacation. So. Anyway, Yom, day. This is from the exhaustive concordance, Strong's Concordance. It says, "From an unused root, meaning to be hot, a day," and again we saw that, hot day, the daylight portion, "as the warm hours," weather literal, "from sunrise to sunset," or from sunset to the next. So that's your two different definitions for Yom. Again, it can refer to the daylight portion, to the warm portion, or to sunset to sunset. Okay. Vine's Expository Dictionary of Biblical Words, great source. It says Yom has several meanings. The word represents the period of daylight as contrasted with nighttime. And again, we found that in Genesis 1, verse 5. The word denotes a period of 24 hours. And again, when does that begin? Sunset. Sunset. Sunset to sunset. Okay? And I know for most of us, all of us here, I'm sure there's probably those watching, they don't know this. International Standard Bible Encyclopedia says this. One, it sometimes means the time from daylight till dark. Again, that first definition. Two, day also means a period of 24 hours or the time from sunset to sunset. In Bible usage, the day begins with sunset. I'm not going to read the verses, everybody can see them, where night is put before the day. So again, sunset begins. Interestingly, we know that creation began with what? Darkness. Darkness. I don't know if you've ever considered that, but it began with darkness. It did not begin with light. As a day begins with a darkness, creation began with the darkness. Okay, we have another reference here. I believe this is our last reference. Day. This is from the Brown, Driver, and Brooks Hebrew Lexicon. It says a day opposed to the night. And of course, that would be the daylight portion. A day, 24-hour period, that'd be from sunset to sunset. Now, it also can be understood in different ways. Days or lifetime, plural, time, period, general. So it can simply refer to time in general. It doesn't always refer to a day or 24 hours. And also can, in some instances, refer to a year. So these are the examples for the word yom, day. And I think we all understand that. I think we all understand how we determine a day. But again, it's important that we review this because it begins with this comprehension of how do we determine when the day begins. And there are some believers out there that they believe that the day begins at sunrise. The scripture doesn't support that, certainly not for the definition involving the Sabbath and how the days and when the days begin. I want to share with you now a few examples in the Bible showing how Yom is used within the context of scripture. So first example here is Leviticus 11, 31 through 32. So we find Yom within the Genesis 1, verse 5. We find the meaning of Yom through, again, places like Strong's. But we also find the meaning of Yom through Scripture. So as these are unclean to you, now this is referring to the unclean foods, unclean meats. I shouldn't say unclean foods. It's not food. It never was meant for food. It's unclean meat. Unclean meats. So as these are unclean to you among all that creed, whosoever does touch them, when they be dead, it shall be unclean until the even. So notice that it says if you touch an unclean animal, that you will be unclean until the even, or evening, or sunset. And upon whatsoever any of them, when they are dead, doth fall, it shall be unclean. Whether it be any vessel of wood, or raiment, or skin, or sack, whatsoever vessel it be, wherein any work is done, it must be put into water, and it shall be unclean until when? It says until the evening, or until sunset. So it shall be consecrated. So in this passage, again, we have the laws, Yahweh's laws dealing with clean meats, unclean meats. Notice here that Yahweh says that if we touch an unclean animal, that we're unclean until when? He says until even, or the evening, or sunset. Now, what do you suppose he says evening? Why not midday? Why not 3 p.m.? Why not the next morning? Where Scripture says and shows that sunset or even begins a new day. And this is one piece of evidence that shows that Yom does end, the day end with sunset. One of the best examples, I believe, is Leviticus 23, 29 through 32. This is in reference to the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. It says, for whatsoever a soul or a person, by the way, nephesh is that word. A lot of people have this crazy notion that nephesh means an immortal soul. It's never used. In fact, the word immortal soul is never found in Scripture. Soul is simply nephesh. And nephesh means a person, a breathing, living being. It's a person. Of course, you can also be a dead nephesh too in Scripture. Anyway, it says, for whatsoever soul or nephesh it be, that shall not be afflicted. And the word afflicted there is what? Is fasting. So if we don't fast, if we don't afflict our souls, this happens. And that same day, he shall be cut off from among his people. So that's the consequences of not afflicting our souls or ourselves on the Day of Atonement. And whatsoever soul it be that does any work on that same day, that same soul will I destroy from among his people. So if we do any work, the Jews believe that the Day of Atonement is the strictest day of the year. I tend to agree. You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. It shall be unto you a Sabbath of rest, a Shabbat. This is unique, by the way, with the Day of Atonement. Shabbaton is the word used for the other holy days when it's a Sabbath. Here is Shabbat. And I believe the reason is because it is more strict. So Yahweh wanted to use a Shabbat instead of a Shabbaton. It says, you shall afflict your souls in the ninth day of the month at even. From even unto even shall you celebrate your Sabbath. So again, we find here the description of the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. And by the way, Yom Kippur literally means a day of covering. It's a day that Yahweh covered the sins of his people. It's a day that Yahweh covered the sins of Israel, and I believe prophetically points to the reconciliation of Israel at Yahshua's coming. Notice when the day was observed. It says from the ninth day of the month at even, from evening to evening. This is confusing to some people because we know in other passages it says that the Day of Atonement is on the 10th day of the seventh month, but here it says the ninth day. What it's saying here is that we're to keep it from the end of the ninth day through that following evening. Because, well, again, we have many other passages showing and saying that Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is on the 10th day. So we know it's on the 10th day. So that's what it says here. But the point is, we see here that atonement begins at evening, at sunset, not on sunrise or some other time. Begins at sunset, sunset to sunset. Understanding how Yahweh's calendar works, as we find here, is important to the feast days. You see, we can't really observe the feast days as we should if we don't understand how to determine when these days should be kept. For me, the best passage showing when a day begins is Nehemiah 13:19. Nehemiah 13:19 is a really great passage. It says, and it came to pass that when the gates of Jerusalem began to be dark before the Sabbath, I commanded that the gates should be shut, and I charged that they should not be opened until after the Sabbath. And some of my servants set eye at the gates, that there should no burden be brought in on the Sabbath day. So we find here that to prevent the people of Judah from breaking the Sabbath by selling and engaging in commerce on the Sabbath, we find here that Nehemiah commanded that the gates of the city be closed as it was growing dark on the Sabbath. It was growing dark. Now, does it grow dark at sunrise? Have you ever seen that happen? Have you ever seen sunrise and it begins to grow dark? No, it doesn't grow dark on sunrise. It grows light. When does it begin to grow dark? It begins to grow dark at sunset. So that's what we find here. We see here that Nehemiah even threatened force in the story. We find that he threatened force for those who would stay outside and wait for the Sabbath to end. Again, notice the phrase began to be dark. We understand this phrase refers to sunset, refers to the sun going down, not to the sun going up. All right, for clarity's sake, I want to share this from a few other passages or versions. So the New International Version says, when evening shadows fell on the gates before the Sabbath. Or you don't see evening shadows at sunrise. You do see evening shadows at sunset. So the NIV shows that they shut the gates right before the Sabbath because, again, he wanted to keep the Sabbath holy. He wanted to remove commerce. He did not want people engaging in buying and selling on the Sabbath. Revised or Standard Version reads, when it began to be dark at the gates before the Sabbath. So it was dark. It wasn't noon, it wasn't 3 p.m. It was dark, it was growing dark. Last one here is a New Jerusalem Bible, which by the way, is a Catholic Bible, for those who may not know. Yahweh's name's all throughout the Old Testament. If you ever find an old New Jerusalem Bible, you'll see Yahweh's name throughout it. But it says, so when the gates were getting dark at the approach of the Sabbath. So we see some other examples here. No matter what translation we read from, they all say the same thing. And that is, as the Sabbath was approaching, it was becoming dark. The evening shadows were falling. So what evidence does this prove or provide for? Well, it shows that the day, specifically the Sabbath, begins at sunset, not sunrise or some other time, sunset. And that's an important concept for us to understand. I want to transition now and move on to the month. How do we determine the month? Now, projecting the new moon is a little bit more complicated. I'm not going to go. I thought about going through that today, but I thought, no, it's going to be too much to go through. It's very complicated in some ways, not a whole lot, but you have to understand things like the azimuth, and you have to understand things like elevate or the altitude and the illumination of the moon and that sort of thing. And even keep in mind that how long it's going to be out and how long it takes to see the moon after sunset and things of that nature. But understanding how to use the moon is actually quite simple. So let's understand how we're to determine the month. Now, the Jewish calendar, they will use a conjunction. Conjunction is that dark moon you can't see. Yahweh's calendar uses a new moon crescent. According to the Barnhart Concise Dictionary of Etymology, the word month is derived from the dramatic word month, which means moon. So the word month means moon. That's what it means. And it's not a surprise it means that when we understand the origin and understand the biblical usage of this word. Now, how do we know that the word that the month begins with the new moon crescent and not the conjunction? Some believers, they use a conjunction. Jews use a conjunction. Of course, others use a conjunction. On our modern calendar, when you see new moon, well, that's the conjunction. And by the way, the word conjunction also, another word for it is the astronomical new moon. So you got the new moon, the astronomical new moon, the conjunction. That's that new moon you see as black. Or that's the full moon. It's just a circle, but you can't see anything, and that's the problem. We find a clue for the new moon crescent in Deuteronomy 16, verse 1. It says, observe the month. I'll just stop there. This is the first part. Observe the month. Yahweh commands us to observe the month. Now, we'll see of Abib. We'll talk about Abib later. Now, how do we observe the month? How do we observe the month? Well, the word observe, as you can see here, is from the Hebrew word shamar, means to hedge about, as with thorns, to guard, generally to protect and to attend to. So that's the meaning of shamar. Shamar generally is to guard. What do we do when we guard something? Just imagine guarding a prisoner. What would you do? You watch that prisoner, right? That's how we guard. And that's really what we find within the Hebrew. Part of the concept of guarding, part of the definition as we find in other places, is to watch. Some will even look narrowly for. I want to share with you another reference here. This is from the Brown, Trevor, and Briggs Hebrew Lexicon. It says to keep, to have a charge of, to keep, to guard, to keep watch and ward, to protect, to save life, to watch for, to watch for, to watch, to observe. So we find this concept included within shamar, to watch. To observe, to keep, to retain, to treasure up, to keep within bonds or bounds, to restrain, to observe, to celebrate, to keep, to perform, to keep, to preserve, to protect, to keep, to reserve. So again, a very broad definition here, but one of the definitions is to watch. Strong's, I believe, says to look narrowly for. Now, with this in mind, what is Yahweh commanding here? Well, he's commanding that we watch for the new moon crescent. We watch for the new moon crescent. And we'll talk more about the new moon here in just a moment. Now, again, some believe that we should be using the conjunction to begin the biblical month. For those who may not know, and I've talked about this already, the conjunction, let me give you a little bit more of a definition here, or understanding. So this is from the Britannica, the Encyclopedia Britannica. It says, quote, "In astronomy, an apparent meeting or passing of two or more celestial bodies, the moon is in conjunction with the sun at the phase of new moon, when it moves between earth and sun and the side turned toward the earth is dark." So from an astronomical standpoint, that is the meaning of conjunction. And again, the thing to keep in mind here is that the astronomical conjunction, or the astronomical new moon, is invisible. You can't see it. You can't see it. Keep in mind that the Hebrew word shamar, though, means to watch or to guard. How do you watch for something you can't see? How do you look for something that's invisible? Or you can't. You can't. So the obvious answer here is that it can't be the conjunction, because Scripture says that we need to look for the new moon. Now, I want to share with you a few other references. Some of these I've shared in the past, and with you I have not. So, first one here is from Strong's. Again, this is new moon. This is new moon. Kodesh is the meaning of the, or is a Hebrew, and it means new moon. The new moon, by implication, a month. So it can be used in reference to the new moon crescent or to the month. And we see examples of that. Now, new moon, the primitive root, and everything goes back to a primitive root. Primitive root is Kadash, and it means to be new or to rebuild. So that's one clue what a new moon is. It's in the process of rebuilding. It's something new. But if it's something new and rebuilding, or something we can see, and not something that is invisible. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, which is a great source, by the way, and this particular quote is enlightening. It says, a Hebrew-Jewish calendar had three stages of development. That's important to remember, three stages. So it's evolved with time. The pre-exilic or biblical, so the pre-exilic or biblical, that's what we're talking about today. The biblical way of determining Yahweh's calendar. The post-exilic, or the Talmudic, and the Talmudic would be the rabbinic, and the post-Talmudic, more rabbinic. The first rested on observation merely, so it's just something we had to go out and look for. Whether it's the agriculture, whether it's a new moon crescent, it's something we physically had to go out and look for, to see, to visualize. The second on observation coupled with calculation, so they were introducing different calculations at that point, and that was, again, the Talmudic and post-Talmudic. And this is something Hillel II did. It says a third on calculation only. So there was no more observation, nothing to look for. It's all on observation or all on calculation. And that's using the autumnal equinox, the fall equinox. And then they use a conjunction. Of course, they add their postponements and other items as well. It says in the first period, the priests determined the beginning of each month by the appearance of the new moon. By the appearance of the new moon. There's no appearance for the conjunction because there's nothing to see. This next source is a New Unger's Bible Dictionary. It's a good and great source. It describes how they would look for the new moon during Yahshua's time. It says that the festivals, according to the Mosaic law, were always to be celebrated on the same day of the month it was necessary to fix the commencement of the month. So they had to have a way to start the month. This was determined, it says, by the appearance of the new moon. So you had to see it. Again, it wasn't something that was invisible. For the new moon was reckoned not by astronomical calculation, but by actual personal observation. I really like how they phrase that. It wasn't something we determined by calculation, but by something we actually went out and witnessed and saw. And that's why I encourage everybody to really take the new moon seriously. Yahweh does. You know, in the Word, I'm not going to read it, but we know it. Isaiah 66, it says, all flesh will worship me on the Sabbaths and new moons. You know, I would encourage everybody, just as a side note, to maybe mark it on your calendars, to really, especially these winter months when it's easy to observe. Summer months it's hard. But right now this is like prime opportunity. So I would encourage everyone to do your very best to try to observe the new moons. They're important. But again, we see here that it was reckoned by personal observation. It says, on the 30th day of the month, watchmen were placed on commanding heights around Jerusalem to watch the sky. As soon as each of them detected the moon, he hastened to a house in the city, kept for the purpose, and was there examined by the president of the Sanhedrin. When the evidence was of the appearance was deemed satisfactory, the president stood up and formally announced it, uttering the words, "It is consecrated." The information was immediately sent throughout the land from the Mount of Olives by beacon fires on the top of the hill. So that's how they would communicate the sighting of the new moon. And you may want to remember that. That's how they would communicate that through the beacon fires. It says the religious observance of the day of the new moon may plainly be regarded as the consecration of a natural division of time. And it is. It's not a holy day. Some believe that the new moon is a Sabbath day. It's not a Sabbath day. It is a day, though, that we should be coming together. Another reference here is the Encyclopedia Judaica, another great reference here. Volume 12, page 1039. It says, originally, the new moon was not fixed by astronomical calculation, but was solemnly proclaimed after witnesses had testified to the reappearance of the crescent of the moon. It's reasons like this that gives me pause when people say, or the Jews did this. Because one thing about the Jews is when they did change something, they will admit to it. They will admit to it. So if somebody comes to me and says, well, that's something the Jews did, but there's no historical evidence or no confirmation, well, I'm hesitant. Because generally speaking, the Jews are very open to their changes. And they say here, originally it was not by astronomical calculation, but they went out and looked for the appearance, reappearance of the crescent. That's how they determined the moon or the month. It says by the middle of the 4th century, we'll see more evidence of that, the sages, and the guy that we should know is Hillel II, had established a permanent calendar in the public. Proclamation of the new moon was discontinued. They didn't do it anymore. Now, I will say there's a quasi-Sanhedrin that's been developed. I say quasi because I don't think it's anything just horribly official. But here recently, this has been a while ago, and maybe they still do it, they actually went out and looked for the new moon in Israel. And they reported on it, and they said they really saw the benefit of looking for the moon. And there was a connection there for them. So here's another reference. Another source, again, this is from a Jewish source, Encyclopedia of the Jewish Religion, page 78, says, until Hillel II, there it is, a permanent calendar based on calculation around 360. So that's when this, and you may want to remember that date, but 360, the fixing of the new moon was determined by observation of the evidence of witnesses. So before that, before Hillel II changed everything, we find that the new moon was determined by actual witnesses. Now the last reference I want to share, and this is something new, and this is from the Mishnah. This is a Jewish source. And we find evidence how they observed the new moon, how the Jews observed the new moon from the Mishnah. It's very enlightening. It says, how do they examine, this is again directly from the Mishnah, says, how do they examine the witnesses who come to testify about the new moon? They deal with them in order as a pair of witnesses that arrives first, they examine first. They bring in the greater of the two witnesses and they say to him, say, how you saw the moon? Was it in front of the sun or behind the sun? To its north or to its south? How high was the moon over the horizon? And in which direction did it tilt? And how wide was it? If, for example, he said that he saw the moon in front of the sun, he has not said anything of substance, or you can't do that. As this is impossible, and therefore he is either mistaken or lying. So he wanted to, you know, ask these questions that if they're lying or they've never done this, or maybe they're going to say something they shouldn't. And after they finish hearing the first witness's testimony, they should bring in the second witness and examine him in a similar manner. So they require at least two witnesses. And their statements if their statements match, their testimony is accepted, and the court sanctifies the new moon. And the court then asks all other pairs of witnesses certain general matters without probing into all the details. They do this not because they require the additional testimony, but so that the witnesses should not leave disappointed, and so that the witnesses should be accustomed to coming to testify. They don't want to discourage anybody. If you're going to go through the effort of going out looking, they want to make sure that they get your report. That's great leadership. I think that's a great, great practice there, but they don't want to disappoint anybody. And it goes on to say, we'll not hesitate to come in the next time when they might be needed. After the witnesses have been examined and their testimony accepted, the head of the court says it is sanctified, and all the people respond after him, it is sanctified. It is sanctified. So we see here multiple references, multiple sources, scholars from the Jewish alike. They all verify the same thing, how to determine the new moon. And you determine the new moon by actual observation. You determine the new moon by looking for and seeing the new moon crescent. In fact, we see here that they would look for and communicate the sighting of the moon, how they would do this. It says here that they would light beacon fires on the top of the mountains so that those in distant locations would see the communication, and they knew that there was a new month. So this is how they communicated. And again, you just may want to remember that as well. As I mentioned, some of the Jews are doing this today. So they recognize the biblical method of determining the year. I want to transition now to the biblical year and begin by reviewing the use of the vernal or spring equinox. Now, this may be a question many have this year, because, again, I tend to believe, could be wrong, I hope I'm wrong, tend to believe, though, that it will probably be early. And I'm sure if we're early, people will be saying, well, why are you early? Why aren't you doing it like the Jews are doing it? Why aren't you following the vernal equinox? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? So I want to make sure that I explain why we don't use, I don't think I have to explain why we don't go with the Jewish calendar. Hopefully we all understand that. But we may not understand why we should not use the equinox. So let's go through that. Let's understand the equinox. So what is the equinox, first and foremost? What is the equinox? So the equinox is when the sun crosses the equator when day and night are equal. That's the equinox. So it's an astronomical calculation. It's when, again, the sun crosses the equator and when the day and night are equal length. Now, the vernal equinox occurs around March 20th, and the autumnal equinox around September 22nd. So you have the vernal equinox, and you have the autumnal equinox. Whereas then you have the summer solstice and the winter solstice. And these are astronomical metrics that begins the different seasons. But Yahweh's calendar, the agriculture, doesn't always follow these astronomical calculations. In fact, a few years ago, just as a side note, I was, I think I just logged into Fox News, and it had an article in Fox News talking about how the astronomical calendar does not follow the agricultural calendar. Now, there are some years when the astronomical calendar is a bit ahead. And that's what we may have next year. Because many who use the equinox, they will then use the new moon that comes after the equinox. And I believe that it may, I'm hoping not, but may be before the equinox, the new moon, the Abib new moon. So many will use Genesis 1 verse 14 as evidence for the equinox. It says, there, and Elohim said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night. And let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. Now the word season here comes from the word moed. I provided the definition there on the screen. Moed means an appointment that is a fixed time or season, specifically festival, conventionally a year, by implication an assembly. We know that moed most often refers to the feast days, Yahweh's days of worship. It says here that day and night, representing the sun and moon, are to be used for signs, seasons, days, and years. Those who believe that we should use the equinox as a sign or marker that beginning the year will point this out. They will say, look, here's the mention of the sun, along with the word moed. And based on this, they then say that this provides evidence of the equinox. I don't see it. I don't see it. I don't see evidence here of the equinox. I see no mention here that thou shalt use the equinox when you begin the year. I don't see it. I see Yahweh basically saying, I've given you the sun, I've given you the moon, and I've given these two things for you for these reasons. But how we're to use these items, we must look elsewhere. We must understand this is simply too generic, this is simply too vague to draw any conclusions from. There's nothing here to say we're to use the equinox. There's nothing here to say we should use the barley. It's simply saying that I've given you these two timekeepers, the sun and moon, and you're to use these for these things, but doesn't go into more detail. So how do we determine the use of the moon and the sun and moon? One of the great passages for this is Psalms 104:19. Psalms is an encouraging book. Most people, they think of encouragement when they think of Psalms. If you're down or depressed, go read Psalms. The Psalms also has prophecy. Psalms also has theology, doctrine. Psalms 104:19 says, He appointed, Yahweh appointed the moon for seasons. The sun knows his going down. So it says here that Yahweh appointed the moon for what? What did Yahweh say here? He appointed the moon for what? It says here that he appointed the moon for seasons. Seasons. Now again, the word season here is moed, same word found in Genesis 1 verse 14. So from this, what do we know? Well, we know that he appointed the moon for seasons or for Yahweh's feast days. So that's how we determine the feast days. We do it through the start of the month. And we know that by the new moon, not by the sun. You see, the sun doesn't determine the month. We don't use the sun to determine the month. We use the moon to determine the month. Goes on to say here, but the sun knows his going down. So what do we see there? We see there that the sun knows his going down. The sun determines the beginning, the end, and the beginning of a day. We use the sun, we use the moon, but they're used for unique purposes. We use the sun for the day, and we use the moon for the month. It's not complicated. But you can't go back to Genesis 1:14 and read that passage and say, we're to use the equinox based on this. There's absolutely no evidence that would give credence to the use of the equinox based on what we find in Genesis 1:14. And when we dig deeper with Psalms here, we see Yahweh confirming how we're to use these celestial bodies, how we're to use the sun, how we're to use the moon. We're to use them both. He's given them for purpose and for reasons. Again, we're to use the sun to mark the day, and we're to use the moon, the new moon crescent, to mark the month. It's not real complicated. It really isn't. Now, I want to move on and talk about a Hebrew word. And that Hebrew word is tekutvah. A lot of people believe that tekutvah refers to the equinox, refers to the vernal equinox. And they will use this word to say, hey, there's evidence of the vernal equinox. So I'm going to go through the use. Tekutvah is only found in a few places, but before we look at the examples, I want to define the word. So tekutvah, 8622 in the Old Testament Strong's. And it means a revolution that is of the sun, course of time, or lapse. So it's just a revolution. That's all it is. It's a revolution of time. And we're going to see in biblical usage, it doesn't always refer to the sun. In fact, most often it doesn't refer to the sun. It refers simply to some sort of circuit, some sort of revolution, including birth, by the way. We'll see that as we go through. The Brown Driver Briggs defines tekufa as a coming around or coming round, a circuit of time or space, a turning, a circuit. So that's the meaning of the word tekufa. Based on the definition here, do you see evidence for the equinox? Do you see where it says here tekufa means equinox? Or the answer is no. It simply refers to a revolution of the sun or some other type of revolution, some space or time. Now, the word tekufa is found only four times in the Hebrew Old Testament. Four times. So I thought it's only mentioned four times. Let's look at each one. And we'll do this pretty quickly here, but I'm going to look at each example. And you tell me, You tell me whether you see evidence here for the equinox. Exodus 34, verse 22, it says, thou shalt keep or shall observe the Feast of Weeks, of the first fruits of wheat harvest, and the Feast of Ingathering, which is tabernacles, at the year's end. At the year's end. Now, the word end here is the Hebrew word tekufa. How's this word used? Is it used within the context of the vernal equinox, the spring equinox? It refers to the time of the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Ingathering, and to the end of the agricultural year. So it's not in reference to the equinox, and it's not even in reference to the spring time. It's in reference to the fall. It's important to understand that the seventh month marks the end of that year's harvest. You see, the next year really begins in the month of, or in the eighth month. It's kind of like today, right? The year's not ended yet, but they're planting crops already for the next year. So they plant the winter barley is what determines the Abib. And they plant the winter barley around November-ish, the eighth and ninth month of the Hebrew calendar. That's when Israel would plant the winter barley. And it's still when they plant the barley. And in springtime, where the barley is mature. And that's how they determine, not to get ahead, but that's how they determine. So as the day begins in the previous day, if you will, or sunset, even the year works the same way to an extent. But again, we find no evidence of the vernal equinox here. We find no evidence to the springtime here. It refers to the Feast of Ingathering in the fall time. So let's move on to another example of tekufa. It says in 1 Samuel 1, verse 20, it says, wherefore it came to pass when the time was come about after Hannah had conceived, that she bore a son, called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked him of Yahweh. So the phrase here, was come about, is tekufa. Was come about is tekufa. Now, what is this phrase referring to? Is it referring to the vernal equinox? It's referring to the end of Hannah's pregnancy, the mother of Samuel. It's not referring to the equinox. It's not referring to the sun, the revolution of the sun at all. It's referring to the end of pregnancy. So we've seen two examples, and I want to show you a trend here. First example was referring to the fall or end of the agricultural year. Second example is referring to the end of pregnancy. But it's both end. But many people, they will use this word tekufa, and they will say, look, here it is. Here's the evidence. Here's evidence for the vernal equinox. The problem is, number one, it doesn't mean equinox, period. And two, it generally refers to the end of the cycle, not to the beginning. And for this to work at all, which even if it would refer to the springtime, which it doesn't, but if it did, still does not mean equinox. But it's even more problematic with the fact that it refers to the end of a cycle, not to the beginning. So it refers here to the pregnancy, not to the equinox. 2 Chronicles 24:23 says, and it came to pass at the end of the year that the host of Syria came up against him, and they came to Judah and Jerusalem and destroyed all the princesses of the people from among the people and sent all the spoil of them unto the king of Damascus. So again, the word end here is the Hebrew tekufa. What is it referring to? Or it's referring to the end of a year. The end of a year. So it follows this trend. It's not referring to the beginning. It's not referring to the beginning of the cycle. It refers to the end of the cycle. Now, do I believe theoretically it can refer to the beginning of it? Yes, I do, theoretically. But the biblical examples show that it refers to the end of a cycle, whether it be the end of the year, whether it be to the end of the agricultural season, whether it be to the end of a pregnancy. It refers to a cycle, to a revolution, but it refers to the end of that revolution. It's important that we understand that. One more example here, Psalms 19, verse 6, it says, his going forth is from the end of heaven and his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. Now, if we back up to verse 4, I'm not going to read it, but if we back up, we read the context, we're going to see that this is referring to the circuit of the sun. So one of four examples refers to the Son. The other three examples does not, not biblically. But here this is a reference to the Son. It simply is referring to the cycle of the Son. But based on this, some will say that this is evidence of the equinox. But again, do you see the word equinox here? Do you see the usage of the equinox here? Do you see even a hint to the equinox here? I see nothing about the equinox here. This is simply showing that the sun is a circuit, that the sun has a rotation. We understand that. And it refers to the end of that rotation here, not to the beginning. There is absolutely no biblical passage example showing that Tekufa refers to the equinox. And worse yet, there's no biblical example referring or showing that this refers to the springtime. You see, to connect this with a vernal equinox, you would have to show that this refers to the springtime. It does not. It does not refer to the beginning of a cycle. It refers to the end of the cycle. You cannot use Tekufa for the equinox. And you cannot use Genesis 1:14 for the equinox. It does not fit. It does not fit. It's simply, there is absolutely, unequivocally, no evidence for this claim. So if not for the equinox, how then do we begin the biblical year? How do we start the biblical year? Well, the answer is actually found within the name of the first biblical month. In fact, some will say that it's not a name, but a description. A description, I kind of believe that. So one of the best examples, we've already seen it once. I'm going to go back to it. I'm going to give you the expanded version this time. Deuteronomy 16, verse 1, it says, "Observe the month of Abib and keep the Passover unto Yahweh, your Elohim. For in the month of Abib, Yahweh, your Elohim, brought you forth out of Egypt by night." Now, we've already looked at the first part of the phrase here, where it says to observe the month. Of course, that means to watch for the new moon, right? We should understand that. Observe the month, Shamar Kodesh. Look for the new moon. But then it says, we're to look for the new moon of what? It says we're to look for the new moon of Abib. Abib. You know, many read this passage and never realizing what they're reading. The answer as to when we begin the biblical year is found within the meaning of Abib. It's so important that we understand the meaning of Abib. So we're going to really delve into this, and I want to do this first. What is the meaning of Abib? I've seen videos done by those who believe we should be using the equinox. They'll quote some of this, but they will admit parts of the definition. I know why. Because you can't read a definition for Abib and not realize there's a connection with the agriculture. You just can't. It's impossible to read a definition for Abib and disconnect the use of agriculture. You just can't do it. So anyway, this is from Strong's. It says, Abib, from an unused root, meaning to be tender. And I've heard people quote this, and they'll stop right there. And they won't quote anything else. It goes on to say, though green, that is a young ear of grain. A young ear of grain, hence the name of the month Abib, or Nisan. Nisan's the Babylonian name for it. The Jews picked up a lot of things in Babylon. They changed a lot of their names, the calendar month, the names of the month with Babylonian names. That's an example. The brown driver Briggs says, month of ear forming, of greening of crop, of growing grain, Abib, the month of the Exodus and the Passover. So again, we see through these two definitions a connection with what? A connection with growth, a connection with crops, a connection with grain. It's very clear what we find within the Hebrew for Abib. It doesn't say equinox. Nothing. Nothing in there says equinox. Two more definitions here. This is my favorite one, the theological word book of the Old Testament, because technically it's right on. It's right on. It says a barley that is already ripe but still soft. The grains which are either rubbed or roasted. We'll talk more about this, but there's different stages of growth for barley. And one is the dough stage, and then one is when they're fully ripened, and that occurs after the dough stage. But the dough stage is Abib. So the dough stage is Abib. And certainly anything after that can be considered Abib, but the dough stage is really that first fruits. So that'd be Abib. Now, the Wilson's Old Testament Word Studies, it's an okay reference, not great, but okay, says the name of the month, so-called, is corn. Who knew that the Middle East does not have corn as we have? Now, they may have it today, but it's certainly not native. So corn, when you see corn in Scripture, it means grain. So when you see corn, never don't think they're eating cobs of corn, corn cobs. They're eating grain, wheat or barley, more than likely. Says, was then forming in the air a few weeks before harvest. So notice, a few weeks before harvest is Abib. So it's just, it's that first fruits. It's that first fruits. Says, falling somewhere around March or April afterward, called Nisan, the first name or the first month of the Hebrew year. So based on these definitions, how do we define Abib? Well, the most basic definition is to simply say Abi means young ears of grain. Young ears of grain. There's a little bit more to it. Again, I like the definition from the Theological Word Book. It describes Abi as grain that is already ripe. In other words, you can produce flour from it, but still soft. And you do this by either rubbing or roasting the ears. Sometimes if it's in the soft dough stage, there's dough there, but there's also water or moisture. So to remove that, you roast it. And you roast the ear, it removes that moisture, and then what you have left is that dough. And the dough is what you produce flour from. And that's the whole point of all of this. It has to produce flour. You see, if it can't produce flour, it's not Abib. If you can't use it to bake with, it's not Abib. So the first stage of Abib, what you can use, is the dough stage. The dough stage. There's something called the Zodiac Growth Scale. So they all use it. We use it today. Everybody uses it. It's used within the industry. It refers to grain in general. And the last stage before the grain is fully ripened is the dough stage. And generally, that is what we're looking for Abib. The stage, the soft dough stage minimum, maybe the hard dough stage, depending on where the barley's at. So at this point, I've made the assumption that Abib refers to barley. How do we know that? How do we know that Abib refers to barley? Maybe it refers to wheat or oats or rye. How do we know it refers to barley? It's important that we understand this. We actually find a connection or evidence for this in Exodus 9, verse 31. It says, and the flax and the barley was smitten. And they were smitten. It was the plague of hell. It destroyed. It says, for the barley was in the ear, and the flax was bold. So we know from this passage that this is speaking about the destruction of the seventh plague of Egypt. It says here that the barley was in the ear. Now the word ear is Abib. What it's saying here is that the barley was in Abib. And because of barley was an Abib, it was destroyed. You see, it was brittle enough to be destroyed by the plague of hell. That's why we know, in part, the stage of Abib. Because if it's in the grass stage, it can't be really destroyed yet. It's just too, it bends. There's no stiffness to it, it just bends. In fact, you can see a picture here. This is an actual picture. And this is wheat in the picture. But barley and wheat, they look very close. Same concept. But this was actually destroyed by hailstorm. So you can kind of see the devastation that a storm like this can cause. It can destroy the field. And this is precisely what happened to the Egyptians. When Yahweh poured the plague out upon the Egyptians, he destroyed the barley fields. Because the barley was an Abib, meaning the barley was still brittle enough to be destroyed. Now, based on Exodus 12, verse 2, and I'm not going to go there, but it says, this month shall be unto you the first month of the year. It shows that Yahweh is appointing that month as that new moon as the first month. So we find here in Exodus 9 that the barley was Abib, and then in Exodus 12 we have the new moon. And we then have the commencement of the month of Abib. So as we see in the Bible, to begin a new year, we must wait for the barley to be in the Abib stage, which is the soft dough stage. And then we use than the following new moon crescent, and that will mark Abib. So to make this simple, March 11th, 2024 is when we project, and most likely, I'm very confident that it will be seen March 11th, 2024. So we will need to verify Abib barley by March 11th. That's how this works. We need to verify that there's sufficient Abib barley by the new moon. Because that's what we find in Scripture. Exodus 9, the barley was an Abib. We know the barley was an Abib before the new moon. Exodus 12, verse 2, Yahweh appoints that new moon as the beginning of the month. So that's how we determine the month. So by March 11th, we will look and verify and validate whether the barley is an Abib. And if the barley is not an Abib, or we then will determine March as a biblical leap year, or a 13th month, or Dar 2. And then the next new moon will begin the month of Abib. It's not real complicated. It really isn't. Yahweh didn't want to make it complicated. He made it very, very simple. So simple that any farmer with eyes can observe the calendar. But I want to see a simple farmer do the calculations for the Gregorian calendar. A simple farmer can determine Yahweh's calendar. Anybody can determine Yahweh's calendar. But not so much the many of the modern calendars. Now, some believe that we need large portions of the field to be ripe to call Abib, to determine the month of Abib. Do we need that? How much barley, I'm going to get real technical for just a few minutes. How much barley do we need to begin the month of Abib? How much barley? Well, we find the answer in Leviticus 23, 14 through 15. And this is speaking about the way sheaved during unleavened bread. Everything about Yahweh's calendar and about the culture was agriculturally based. That is so important to understand. If we don't understand that the Israelites lived in an agricultural society, we're going to miss it every time. Because it's agriculturally based. Anyway, here's what it says. And it says that you shall eat neither bread, so, you know, barley that's fully ripe, nor parched corn or grain. And parched corn is when we would roast it. Nor green ears, until the self same day that you have brought an offering unto Yahweh your Elohim. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings, and you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath. And that's Sunday, by the way. Some people get confused with this. And it's always a Sunday within the feast. It's not the Sunday after the feast, as some do it. It's always a Sunday. This, the wave sheaf, everything about unleavened bread is about the wave sheaf. The wave sheaf represents the first fruits of the barley harvest. Now, why in the world would you offer that outside of the feast? Some do. It also represents Yahshua's resurrection. Yahshua wasn't resurrected after the feast. He was resurrected during the feast. We should be observing this during the feast. The morrow after the Sabbath is the same way. It's like saying the Sunday during the feast. To uncomplicate this. The Sunday during the feast. Anyway. Goes from the day that you brought the sheaf, the wave offering. So once they bring the offering in and they wave this offering to Yahweh, it's the first fruits of the barley harvest, then they commence the harvest, but not before. You can't even eat. As the seven Sabbaths shall be completed, and the seven Sabbaths, that's in reference to Pentecost. Pentecost, you have seven complete Sabbaths, you had a 50th day, and you have Pentecost. And since it begins on a Sunday, or lands on a Sunday. It ends on a Sunday with Pentecost always falling on a Sunday. Before we talk about the amount of barley needed to begin Abib, notice what it says here in the beginning. It says here that Israel was not to eat of the barley until it was offered to Yahweh. Again, we need to put on our agricultural hats. We need to understand agriculturally why this is important. Based also on Deuteronomy 69 and Jewish antiquity, Josephus and others, they confirm that Israel could not harvest anything or eat of the grain until the wave sheaf offering. You know, from an agricultural standpoint, this is an important fact to comprehend. This is really, so I just want to impress and really emphasize this point. Why is this important to understand? Why is this important to comprehend? You do not leave barley in the field after it reaches maturity. And if you postpone the month by the use of the equinox, in certain cases, you will be leaving that field weeks in the field after maturity. You just can't do that. Now, we'll talk more about that here in just a few moments. I want to talk about sheaf here. It says we're to bring a sheaf of barley. What is a sheaf of barley? Or a sheaf, the word is Hebrew, and Hebrew is omer, and is about one-tenth of an ephah, which works out to about 5 pints or a half a gallon. So that's the amount of barley they would require to start Abib. It's not much. About a half a gallon of barley. Now, it needs to be a field, I believe. Some people, they'll go out and all the different, pick a stalk here and a stalk there. No, it has to be from the field. But it's not much. You don't have to have most of the fields ripened. Do you realize also that normally Israel's harvesting about 2 months. 2 months. Because it doesn't ripen all at the same time. The elevations, the temperature is different. And it ripens at different times, so they harvest. This is the first fruits. This is your first to reach this Abib stage, which normally happens in the south. And that's where they normally look. They'll look in the south, southern Israel, where the barley matures quicker than in the north. And again, what's important here is to realize, from an agricultural standpoint, what happens when barley reaches maturity. What happens is the barley begins immediately, from what I've been told, it immediately begins to lose nutrients and is susceptible to the environment. I'm not a farmer. I would never pretend to be a farmer. So I called a guy at MFA. It's a farming place here in town. As I heard another minister describe this, and trust but verify, I trust this guy pretty well, but I wanted to verify it. So I asked the guy, I said, do you know anyone who raises barley? And he said, I do. I've raised barley for years. What's the odds? And so I said, I have a question. If you raise barley, and once it reaches maturity, should you leave it in the field? And he says, absolutely not. He says, let me give you an example. And let me try to remember this example. So he gave me an example. He said, let's say you get a real hard rain. And do we have hard rains in Missouri? We have hard rains. And let's say it gets real hot afterwards. Does it get hot after it rains? Sadly, it does. And let's say then you get a windy day. It's windy. Which is what happens then in that particular case is there's an outer shell to the kernel. It shrivels up, falls off, and the wind then will destroy the crop. So he said, you want to get the crop out as soon as it reaches maturity. You'll never want to leave that crop in the field for a month. But that's precisely what those who use the equinox would be doing, because they can't harvest. They can't harvest until the wave sheaf is offered. So they're going to be forced to watch that crop in the field possibly mature beyond the point and possibly even lose that crop. So from an agricultural standpoint, it makes no sense at all. And I've talked to the farmers. This is not me. I'm in IT. I don't know farming. I've talked to the farmers. I've asked the farmers. And they've validated this point. You do not leave barley. And he went on to say that you don't do the same with rye or wheat. In fact, if you notice, he said, or he shared with me, he says, there comes a point where you will literally be in your tractor and you're just waiting. You're waiting. And you can be harvested at night because you don't want to wait for the next day. It's that critical to get that crop out of the field, he said. So you don't want to wait more or less a month. You don't want to wait a day. There's no way they'd wait a month. So it just doesn't work out. It just does not work out. And I would really encourage anyone, using that method to maybe reconsider. Okay, so where are we at here? Talked about Abib. Talked about first fruits. We've talked about the environment of the weather and how susceptible to the weather once it reaches the maturity. So I think we've talked about all that. So we've talked a lot about agriculture. It's important to remember that the Israelites were an agricultural people. Everything for them centered around agriculture, including the calendar. The calendar was also all about agriculture. To drive this point home, I want to share something else with you. Scholars discovered what they call the Giza calendar, the Giza calendar. Now, the Giza calendar is an ancient inscription discovered during archaeological excavation in Giza, thus the Giza calendar. And that's an archaeological site in modern-day Israel today. Now, it's a limestone plaque containing an inscription in Paleo-Hebrew dating back to about the 10th century BCE. So it's an old inscription. It provides agricultural activities and tasks relating to each of the different months of the year. So I want to share this with you. I think we may even have... Do we have a replica of the Giza? I think I should have asked. It's not real big, by the way. What is it? Maybe it's not real big. It's just a small little stone, limestone tablet. Anyway, here's the image, and it is pretty small. But here's the so some of it is worn off. You can't see all of it, but scholars have put the pieces back together, if you will. And here's the inscription based on scholarship: 2 months harvesting. So that'd be September, October. 2 months sowing. I mentioned that. November, December. So you sow for the previous year, and that sowing begins November, December, roughly. 2 months late planting, January, February. 1 month cutting flax, so the flax comes first, and that's March. And then 1 month reaping barley. Notice that, April. So according to the Giza calendar, April was depicted by what? By barley. And that makes a lot of sense when you think of harvesting or reaping the barley. Because sometimes the barley is an Abib in March, but you generally would not reap the barley until April. So that makes a lot of sense from an agricultural standpoint. 1 month reaping and sowing, that'd be May. 2 months pruning, June and July. Those are your vines, grapes, I believe, and that sort of thing. 2 months pruning, 1 month, and that'd be for the fruit, and that'd be August. And the Abia was the name of the scribe that wrote this. So this is, again, called the Giza calendar. Now, to restate the obvious here, this shows that the biblical calendar is based on what? Is based on agriculture. Do you see a reference here to April with the insertion of Tekufa? I mean, if assuming... No, we see nothing here about any astronomical calculation. It's all about the agriculture. All about the agriculture. So this is great indication here of how the Israelites viewed life. They viewed life through agriculture. How did life begin on earth? Agriculture. Where did Yahweh put Adam and Eve? In a garden. You see, Yahweh's always preferred, I guess, agriculture. And for the Israelites, this was certainly true. And this also was included with a calendar. And again, just one more point to drive home. When do we see the month of Ab, or when do we see barley mentioned? In April. As we should. As we should. And that, by the way, that's how Yahweh keeps his seasons in line. Just as a side note, the Islamic calendar, it doesn't have that mechanism. It has 12 months, I won't give you everything. The 12 months, but those months float around, depending on the year. It can be in summer, then enough time goes by, and it can be in winter. There's no way to keep that in sync with the seasons, but Yahweh gave us a way. So just real quickly, I want to review three things. We should all know them by now. We determine the day, how, sunset. We determine the month, how, by the first visible crescent. We determine the year, how, by the barley followed by the next new moon. Very, very simple. So in the case of the upcoming year, and for many of us, we may get questions. I'm hoping this will help us, will equip us to explain why we have two different dates this year, one for March and one for April. Because again, Yahweh's calendar is based on agriculture. It's based on observation. It's based on what we can visually verify and see. not based on the conjunction, not based on these astronomical calculations. No, it's based on what we can see. It's based on the season. It's based on the agriculture. So I pray and hope that this has been a good review, and may Yahweh bless you.